We get things underway in this second hour by welcoming to the show a history professor at Boston College, the author of a number of books, including West from Appomattox, The Reconstruction of America After the Civil War, To Make Men Free, A History of the Republican Party, and her newest, which is absolutely tremendous, How the South Won the Civil War, Oligarchy, Democracy, and the Continuing Fight for the Soul of America. We're pleased to welcome Heather Cox Richardson. Heather, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Rich. I'm a big fan.
Thank you. Well, I'm a big fan of yours, and this book is absolutely wonderful and frightening all at the same time. And it's proof that in history, what goes around comes around.
Well, we always like to say that that history doesn't exactly repeat itself, but it certainly rhymes, and I think you can see that in the present for sure. How much the kind of patterns we're living with today look a lot like ones we've lived through in the past.
And your book chronicles what you're calling the second rise of American oligarchy.
Yes, that's right. So one of the ways I got into this book was it occurred to me, you know, I live in the 19th century, and I know those guys really, really well. And it struck me as I was reading the news how much today's politicians and some of today's big thinkers sound like the elite slaveholders of the 1850s are using the exact same language. Mm. And that really struck me, and I wanted to see why and how that happened. And there was also this really interesting period in the 1890s when the same sort of language happened, but the robber barons, as they were known at the time, didn't take over American society. So what made that different? And, you know, this book was a really long time doing the thought work as well as the research, because it's a big sweeping story and an awful lot goes on.
And I was stunned at the notion that 150 years ago, there were a lot of people in this country who argued, see if this sounds familiar, that taxes were a form of stealing from hardworking Americans to give to those who were too lazy to work.
Isn't that interesting? Everybody talks about the America's fear of socialism or communism coming after the 1917 Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. And the reality is it happens in 1871, because in 1870, African American men get the right to vote at the same time that we have national taxation for the first time. And people who are opposed to African American voting say, you know, actually, we don't mind that black people are voting. That's fine with us. It's not about race. What we mind is that poor people are voting, and they're going to vote for policies that are going to cost tax dollars. And, of course, those tax dollars are going to have to be paid for by the only people who have money, the white guys. And so what this amounts to is a redistribution of wealth from hardworking white men to lazy African Americans. And because it's a redistribution of wealth, it's a form of socialism. And that word socialism sweeps across America starting in 1871. The same year that there's an event in Paris where workers take over the city of Paris and call themselves a commune. So Americans start to worry not only about socialism, but communism. And it's not the 20th century version that we all think about when we hear that word. It's this old construction of if you let poor people vote, they're going to vote for policies that are essentially giveaways to them through tax dollars from people who are hardworking. And that's the exact same formula that you hear nowadays and have heard really since about 1978.
And the mythology about America that goes back to the very founding of the country, the idea that all men were created equal at a time when the people writing that held slaves, when women weren't even factored in, and originally it was only the white male landowners who could vote. And as you point out in the book, our founders, many of them believed that freedom required slavery. Can you explain that?
Yeah, it's a really interesting concept, because that's the central paradox in American history. And I'm not the first person at all to identify that. The person who really talked about it was a historian named Edmund Morgan in 1970 in a book called American Slavery, American Freedom. And he said, you know, what do you do with this idea that the same guys who came up with the idea of human freedom written into law also enslaved people? I mean, how do you manage that? And of course, he's only looking at the relationship between white men and African-American men. And what I hope to have done here is added women and other people of color, American Indians and Hispanics and Chinese and, you know, all the people that 19th century Americans were so concerned about, including Fiji Islanders, who figured very big in their mythology. That's why there's a Fiji Islander in Moby Dick. But the idea behind it is that you can't conceive in the 1700s of a world of human freedom if you include those people who are really in lesser categories. That's people of color or women, certainly, but also poor people. And so the way that the founders were able to conceive of a government based in freedom had to start from the perspective of, we can all be free because they are not. And that you know, that's a very negative thing. But I really don't want to downplay that concept of a government based in the idea of human freedom is profound, it's revolutionary, and we should be exceedingly proud of it. We just need to make sure we really expand it the way it could be expanded.
We're talking with Heather Cox Richardson here on Downtown. Our political parties have transformed greatly over the last 100-150 years, and those who see the present day under a fairly limited lens don't always understand how those transformations took place. And you point to the Kansas-Nebraska Act as a time when the Democratic Party really became the party of slaveholders.
You know, Rich, I love that you picked that up. That's my favorite act in American history. And most people sit there and it's just one more act. Yes, the Kansas-Nebraska Act is the attempt in 1854 to make it legal for slavery to move into the territories, which have been had been since 1820. Half of the Louisiana Purchase is reserved for freedom, and half is reserved for slavery. That's actually the compromise under which Maine came into the Union on May 15th, 1820.
Right.
The Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854 is an attempt of the slave owners to override that and to say we should be able to come into the territories altogether because our enslaved people are property and we should be able to bring our property anywhere we want. But the kicker to that law is that if you can do that, if they can go ahead and bring their enslaved people into all the territories, those new slave states will overawe the free states. And America will become entirely a slaveholding nation, and American democracy will have been completely rewritten. So what happens is the president, who's a Democrat, forces through this bill, and Northern Democrats hate it, but they bow to it for party unity. And when that happens, the more moderate Democrats in the North get entirely voted out of office and get replaced by the Republican Party, the rising Republican Party candidates. And only the most extreme Democrats stay in office in the North, and they start to work with slave owners in the South. So it's essentially a purge of moderate Democrats. And again, you can see parallels with that in the present. The purge really in the 1990s under Newt Gingrich of the people that he called rhinos, Republicans in name only, although in reality they were really quite standard Republicans from the 1950s, 1960s, and 1970s. He said, those guys aren't real. You have to be extremists like us, or you're a rhino. And he really managed to make the Republican Party as extreme in the 1990s as the Democrats made the party extreme in the 1850s.
In the latter part of the 19th century, one of the most powerful politicians in America was Maine's own James G. Blaine. He would serve as Secretary of State, was the Republican nominee in 1884, losing a close race to Grover Cleveland. And he was one of those people at the time who championed the Chinese Exclusion Act.
Yeah, Blaine is such an interesting character. He really is. Blaine has always been about which way the wind is blowing. You know, there are some people who kind of get it. They can read the popular will and they can move along that line. And so James G. Blaine is the what happens is that when the South goes 100% Democratic after 1876, the Republican Party knows it's got to do something, and it doesn't, of course, know that the solid South is going to stay solid, but it knows that it's got to do something to pick up more electoral votes. So they move to the West and they try and court the West, and Blaine is the person who figures out that that's what they have to do. So even though the Republican Party itself hates the Chinese Exclusion Act, they really believe in the idea of individuals being able to come to America and work their way up, Blaine says, we got to get California. And in order to get California, where there's a strong Democratic movement to throw the Chinese out, we've got to go ahead and back this idea of Chinese exclusion. So he is actually the one who starts to bring that that exclusionary hierarchical version of American democracy that has lived in the West after the Civil War back into the mainstream and to move it back into the mainstream of the American East.
The myth of the cowboy also arose about this same time. And the irony, as you point out in the book, is the high percentage of cowboys who were people of color.
That's right, about a third. And they get written out of the equation because the cowboy in America is such a fascinating symbol because people, you know, you talk about Reconstruction, people kind of glaze over and they can't really grab hold of any real individuals in Reconstruction. The cowboy actually overlapped Reconstruction almost exactly, rose in about 1866 and really operates until about 1886 when a terrible winter kills a lot of the cattle herds. And he rises and becomes as important as he does in American mythology, even though there aren't that many of them and they don't last very long, because the cowboy stands as a counterpoint to what Democrats argue is happening in the East. Largely Southern Democrats is happening in the East. And that is what you started with, the idea that the new laws in the American East to protect former enslaved people, freed people, are creating policies that have to be paid for with tax dollars. And therefore, what the government is doing back East after 1871 or so, as I say, to Southern Democrats looks like a form of socialism, that they're killing individual initiative, they're creating lazy people by giving them government handouts through programs that are going to level the playing field between black people and white people. And therefore, somehow the East is developing a form of socialism or this kind of communism they talk about. And standing against that is this image of the cowboy who wants nothing from the government and who is working his way up. And the reality, of course, is that cowboys couldn't survive without the government. The government pours more money and effort into the West than into any other region. But in American mythology, the cowboy becomes this hardworking white man working his way up, really in contrast to that image of the socialism that they believe is happening back East. It's a great story.
One of the first politicians to take advantage of that ideal was Teddy Roosevelt, joining the Rough Riders, becoming the hero of San Juan Hill, and known as a progressive. But as you point out in the book, he also helped to create an ideological underclass. Can you explain that?
You know, so it's funny you say that. The last book, one of the things about the great things about what I do is that you get to learn and change. I was a big champion of Teddy Roosevelt when I wrote my last book, the book of the history of the Republican Party. But as I said, I got to wonder why did the same era in the 1890s that looked so much like the 1850s and the present, why did those robber barons not take over society and ultimately create an oligarchy? Because they had all the pieces. They had the language. They had the culture that circled around them. They had the money. They had the control of government. What happened? How does the progressive era come out of that? And what I have argued in this book is that American paradox that you started with has a corollary. And that corollary is that men of wealth, and now we should say people of wealth, but in the 19th century, men of wealth could use that paradox and say, if people of color and women, and of course they're not using those terms at the time, but if they manage to become equal to white men, they will destroy the equality that white men have. So if American equality depends on inequality for women and people of color, if women and people of color start to approach equality, that by definition should destroy equality for white men. So what I argued with Teddy Roosevelt, and I think this actually explains a lot of that late 19th century period, is that he was able to advance the idea of cleaning up American society, filing the hard edges off of American industry, and raising the hardworking immigrants and the nurturing the middle class, because he was willing to make sure that women and people of color didn't really obtain equality to white men. So by creating an ideological underclass, he was able then to say, see, we're not creating communism, we're not creating socialism. Those, which he was vehemently against, he attacked Democrats for being socialists. We don't have to worry about those people because they're no longer going to be able to affect our voting patterns. They're no longer going to be able to seize tax dollars. So by writing them out of the equation, much the same way as the founders did, he was able then to say, so let's use the government to help the rest of us become more equal. It's a sleight of hand that works rhetorically, and it also helps to work if you look at what Teddy Roosevelt actually did in terms of cleaning up American society and launching the progressive era.
We're talking with Heather Cox Richardson. Her book is How the South Won the Civil War. I could talk to you about this book for hours, but let's skip ahead a little bit. And I wanted to ask you how the Allied victory in World War II changed the way Americans viewed themselves.
So that's such a beautiful moment. If you think about the 1920s and the 1930s, where America was really stratifying, a very few people had a lot of power. And while people liked to pretend they were part of that new economy with its radios and its silk stockings and all the consumer goods that were available to many people for the first time, the reality was that great boom in the 1920s was only accessible to a very few people. And of course, when the bottom falls out of the stock market in 1929, everyone realizes it was only a few people. But America has had this this quite divided society in the teens, especially after World War One and in the 1920s. Well, what happens during World War II is that it has to be all hands on deck. You know, all the old animosities in society have to break down. And that's not to say they do entirely. There are race riots and there's, you know, the Zoot Suit riots in L.A. and there's race riots in Detroit. But everybody gets behind the idea of reasserting American democracy over fascism. And that's a piece that you really have to remember because they're not just fighting a war on the ground and fighting to protect Americans. They're actually fighting an ideological war. And FDR is really clear about this. He keeps saying, you know, fascists say their system is great. Look, they can't even feed themselves. When we go into Italy, we're the ones who feed them because we're a democracy, and democracies grind slowly and they're messy. But in the end of the day, this is the system of government that most serves, that best serves the most people. So all Americans start to pull together to fight for democracy against fascism. And after the war, what that does is it creates this idea that we're all in this together. And you have things like that famous image of Superman saying to the American school children, you know, if anybody tells you that, you know, that we should be divided by race or by color, you tell them that kind of talk is un-American. We're all in this together. So there is this instant almost breaking of that old hierarchical society during World War II. And you see it in the form of the American GI, the general infantry, who doesn't ever he's never identified. The whole point is he's just a regular guy as opposed to some great general who is running everything. Eisenhower, who ran the Allied forces, was adamant that you had to raise up the little guy and make the regular, ordinary Americans feel like they were behind this war because that would emphasize democracy as opposed to fascism's idea of a few great men fighting the war. So you get this real turn on a dime during World War II, and that, of course, is going to affect the rest of the history that I lived through and that some of your older listeners probably did as well.
In the post-war period, no doubt influenced by two decades of having a Democrat in the White House, the Taft Republicans began to use the fear of communism first to try and reverse the New Deal to put pro-business politicians back in power, and they found a messenger, a flawed messenger, in Senator Joe McCarthy during the communist witch hunts, and while he failed, you point out that he showed them the game plan and how to use the media to their advantage.
Yes, and isn't it, and I'll walk you through that, but isn't it interesting how much McCarthy's techniques of simply saying stuff, lying, throwing stuff out there, because he knew it would get media attention, and there wouldn't be time to fact check him until later when no one's paying any attention, how much that now looks like Donald Trump. And of course, they share Roy Cohn,
right,
his advisor. Same guy. And Donald Trump once said the only person he looked up to and who had been a mentor to him was Roy Cohn, Joe McCarthy's right-hand man. But yes, and the point of that, what happens in that magical moment I just talked about, this idea of the resurgence of American democracy, is that for the first time in the 20th century, the American government commits itself to using the government in order to regulate business and provide a basic social safety net and promote infrastructure. And that, the idea of the liberal consensus, is wildly popular, not only among Democrats, but also among Republicans. And there's a rump group of Republicans that are still very much enamored of the way Hoover had done business, and they want to get rid of that New Deal government, that Eisenhower government, and go back to the 1920s when business ran everything. And they had a problem, because the liberal consensus and the idea of using the government to regulate business and to provide a social safety net and to do things like build the interstate highways was so enormously popular that they couldn't get anybody to vote for their policy. So finally, in 1951, William F. Buckley Jr. writes a book, and he says, we got to stop trying to make factual arguments, because when we do that, people keep voting against us. So the way to get them to, we have to start from the premise that this government is wrong, that this is socialism, it's communism. And the way to do that is to create a narrative, to create a story. And then, of course, he is a staunch supporter of Joe McCarthy, the senator who ran the witch hunts in the 1950s, accusing people in Hollywood, for example, of being communists and ruining all kinds of lives. We still have the word McCarthyism from that. He's a big fan of McCarthy, who sort of shows him how to do that by sort of being out there and being flamboyant and telling the story of this, you know, individual, a conservative, as Buckley called him, with a capital C, to distinguish them from traditional conservatives who quite liked the liberal consensus. And this individual guy standing against this group of capital L liberals, which was everybody else in the country, who liked the idea of government regulation and a social safety net, and that this small guy was going to stand up and he was the one who was protecting America. And that technique and that narrative style, really, if you think about it, is the narrative of the late 20th century. Think of Star Wars. Think of, Red Dawn. Think of all the great popular culture of that era, which is the individual standing against a large entity. And as Reagan said, of course, in 1981, you know, government is not the solution to the problem. Government is the problem. And that, again, is just a kind of a straight line right from Hoover on to the present.
And those themes play out in the 1960s, the idea of the Eastern establishment and the rugged individualist, the cowboy, starting with Barry Goldwater's failed bid for the presidency in 64. Roger Ailes enters the picture, helping Nixon with what became known as the Southern Strategy 4 years later, and then the rise of Goldwater 2.0, a smoother, more likable Barry Goldwater in Reagan.
Right, and the key to all of that rise, again, the idea of government regulating business and providing a basic social safety net and promoting infrastructure was and remains extraordinarily popular in America. But what the movement conservatives did is they managed to tie to their narrative that old idea from the 1870s, that an activist government was going to use tax dollars to promote African Americans who are unwilling to work for their own success. And they were able to do that after the 1954 Brown versus Board of Education decision, because at that point, the government was willing to step in eventually with troops to go ahead and level the playing field between Black Americans and white Americans. And of course, troops cost tax dollars. So you get that same theme coming back again and again and again. And it's no accident that the Brown v. Board is 1954 and William F. Buckley Jr. starts National Review in 1955, vowing, as he says, to tell the violated businessman side of the story about why an activist government that regulates business is a negative thing. And the first thing he does, not the first thing, but the, one of the early things he does, is to bring on board James Kilpatrick, who is going to write columns about how desegregation and programs that might help people of color are unconstitutional. They are a redistribution of wealth, taking of one man's property to give it to somebody else.
So, Heather, we've taken way too much of your time, but before we let you go, let's get to Donald Trump. Is he now, if we view it through the lens of history, is he less an anomaly and more the logical conclusion of where this all has been coming for several years now?
Well, I'm going to be annoying and say he's both. I think that the trick to understanding Donald Trump as a man is that he is not a politician. He's a salesman, and he's an extremely good one. I mean, you might not like Donald Trump, but, man, when he gets up and gives an off-the-cuff speech, he doesn't read a speech well, but when he gives an off-the-cuff speech, he reads his audience like almost nobody I've ever seen. He's really terrific at what he does. But he's a salesman. He's not a politician. And he happened into the position he is, and he has, in that position, carried this anti-New Deal policy to its logical conclusion. If you look, he is quite deliberately destroying the federal government. He's doing it right now by saying to states, you know, don't look to the federal government for help, do it yourself. And you actually have people like Gavin Newsom in California coming out and saying, okay, California's going to be a nation state from now on. He is taking that to its logical conclusion. And interestingly enough, if you looked at the 2016 Republican National Platform, party platform for the 2016 election, I remember when it came out, I was actually walking this very road as that I am now, doing an interview with the BBC, just the same way I am right now. And I just kept saying, they kept wanting to talk about Donald Trump. And I kept saying, this is the party platform that Barry Goldwater would have written. This is the old fashioned. This is straight out of Hoover. They are going to destroy the federal government. This is what they're up to. And of course, Donald Trump was running on, I'm going to have universal health care. We're going to make taxes fairer. He was actually speaking as the most moderate Republican in the race when he was campaigning. And that's the salesman in him. But he was running on this platform that was really the 1920s come back to life. And it's actually, in the end of the day, exactly what we've got.
It is an incredibly compelling book, How the South Won the Civil War. Heather Cox Richardson, it's such a delight to talk with you. Thanks so much for being with us this afternoon. And be well, stay safe, and hope we can talk again soon.
You too. Thanks, Rich.